Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by sportsshoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. We hope you're enjoying the bank holiday weekend. This week, we welcome 2016 Rio Olympian Ross Millington to the podcast. Ross trains with Team New Balance Manchester. He's got a 10k PB of 27.55, and he's just ran a 2:11 marathon that saw him qualify for the European Champs this summer.
Yeah, welcome back, guys. Another week. Getting in that summer track season. Some incredible performances already that we've seen. Off the top of my head, Will Paulson, 3:33 last night in the Brian Clay Invitational. So Brits are starting to race out in America, a lot of races going down and a few more coming, so it's an exciting time. We'll probably have to start doing some, get back on the weekly roundups or like, you know, weekend reviews if you like. So look out for those bonus episodes in the future. We've got, you know, the first Diamond League is going to be coming up soon as well. So, but yeah, Millington on this week, obviously spoke to him about that. It was almost like his debut marathon, if you like, because he DNF'd in London a little while back. So, you know, debut completed marathon, 2:11:36, just outside the world's time, and, you know, qualified himself now for the Europeans as well, which seems to be his kind of focus, which, you know, we talked to him, you know, time trial in the championship racing and do enough British marathoners actually target championship races. And I think the introduction of the Union European team competition is huge, and I think that's allowed a lot of British men to actually target a championship marathon instead of kind of, you know, going after a time. So we spoke to Millington about that. We obviously spoke to him about, you know, the big changes we're going to see in New Balance Manchester. Steve Vernon are moving on. Obviously, they've been very close over the years. We talk about his time in New Mexico, you know, when he dominated the cross country for a little period of time, winning the, you know, Liverpool Cross and stuff, going to Europeans, World Cross. So all in all, we cover it all. Millington's kind of been there and done that. And obviously, how could I forget the Olympic Games in 2016 and his experience there? So a very kind of well-rounded athlete with, like, you know, almost like a perfect career. So we get a lot discussed in this episode. So thanks for tuning in once again, and take it easy. We'll catch you next week.
Right, Ross, first of all, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on. We got lots to talk about, as you've already had a long and successful career already. And by the looks of last weekend, plenty more to come as well.
Yeah, hope so. Well, yeah, thanks for having me, guys, and looking forward to having a chat.
Yeah, I mean, we'll start with the recent one. Obviously, well done last weekend. Talk us through, I guess, a bit about the preparations and first off, how the race went from your perspective.
Yeah, so Manchester had been on my calendar for probably, 12 months since last year, really, when I had surgery in the summer, and sort of when I started back running, that was one of the first things that Steve and I put on the calendar. So, you know, I knew from a long way out that I was going to be getting ready for it. There was a small sort of spanner in the works around November time when I had to have a bit of an offload with an injury. So it meant I was coming in sort of end of December, January, sort of only just starting back running, which wasn't ideal. So I sort of started my marathon block as my start of training sort of thing. So there wasn't much wiggle room for, you know, any more time off. You know, injury, illness would have been game over, really. So we knew we had to get it right, and, you know, yeah, fortunately everything went to plan, went really well through the build up, and yeah, managed to get a good performance out on Sunday.
So from around about January until, you know, end of March, you just had that kind of 12-week period. That was it.
Yeah, pretty much. So just, yeah, I was easy running maybe middle of December. And then, like I say, I started sessions in, yeah, some point in January. Can't remember. You were up with us, Ollie, for a few days.
Yeah, that would have been like mid-Jan, I think. Your first session. You'd done a steady run the week before, maybe.
Yeah, and Johnny was 2 minutes ahead of me on some of the final legs. That's why. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that a bit then, because obviously, going into that marathon block, your training partner Johnny Mellor is flying already, and obviously he got the better of you at the weekend, but it's not that 2 minutes, like you say, in a session. So how do you mentally get through that when you know already 12 weeks out, you feel like, I guess, you're not at the same place?
Yeah, so at that point, Johnny hadn't decided what he was doing sort of thing with the marathon. So obviously I was getting back training. He was in really good shape. He was getting ready for half marathons, 10Ks on the road sort of thing. So basically I knew I just had to park my ego and let him go in sessions. Like, Johnny and I have trained together for years, so there's never any sort of, you know, there's never any animosity there. If someone's getting dropped or, you know, the paces are different when they have to be, that's, you know, we'll just get the sessions done, you know, shake hands afterwards and it's good job. And then obviously sort of during the build-up, we were gradually sort of getting closer and closer together. And then it ended up being that most of the sort of key sessions we ran together. And then it was only on some of the long runs that sort of towards the end, he'd sort of do what he needed to do. And I'd sort of stay in a place where I sort of needed to be, because Johnny's, you know, he's an experienced marathon runner. He knows about the training. He knows what he's doing. Whereas it's still fairly new to me. And like the long runs and stuff, I think I learned from 2020 when I DNF'd in London that I'd maybe overcooked things a little bit because I did everything with Johnny in that build up. Like there was probably one session where I dropped him and one session where he dropped me. And sort of when me and Steve looked at that, we probably thought I went in a bit overcooked for that London. So for this one, I made sure that everything was really like B+. Like I never did anything special during this build up. And I just sort of had belief in myself of where I needed to be and what I needed to do on for each session and each long run.
And then what were your aims going into Manchester? Obviously 2:11:36, the world champ team had been picked already, hadn't it? So was it just purely kind of like commies?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm perfectly honest, the only one I focused on was that 2:14:30 for Europeans.
Right, yeah.
Because I really just, obviously I knew I'd gone well, the build-up had gone well, but like I say, everything was just B+ for me, and I could probably show everyone my training, and I don't think many people would say, this guy's going to run 2:11:30 odd. So I was quite surprised with the overall time. If I'm hand on heart honest, I didn't think I'd run that quick. Firstly, because I wasn't sure I was in that shape. You know, I don't have the experience of having done a marathon to say, yeah, I'm in this shape of the marathon. And secondly, I didn't think the race would go that quick. Obviously, we knew what the pace was going to be, hoping for around 2:13 sort of mark. And then, you know, that was sort of giving me wiggle room for if things didn't go too well in the second half to make sure I hit that European standard minimum. So, yeah, I was quite surprised when I got to 23, 24 miles and I was sort of realising, you know, shit, I'm going to break 2:12 here. Like, yeah, it was quite funny, but I'll take it.
What's that like then? Because it must be a lot different to a track race. Obviously, I guess in a 5K, 10K, you still have some thinking time. But in a marathon, obviously Matt and I have never done one, but you must have a lot of time to think about those things and realise those things during the race.
Yeah, too much time, really. I'm still, like, paces still don't mean that much to me. Like, I'll know what average I need to hit a certain time, but if I saw a split at 20, you know, if they're in Ks and stuff, yeah, I'm not in my head doing maths, like, no chance. I saw the halfway split was just over 66 minutes, so I was like, right, I've banked a decent amount of time there. So, and then the rest of it was just process. Like, drink stations are, you know, big help, like, because they do come around quite quick, and it's 3 miles, it's just gone then. So by the time you've got to a drink station, had your drink, you know, the next time you look at your watch, you're like, oh shit, I've only got 2 miles to the next drink station. And it's just process. Like, we knew Ben was pacing to 15 miles. So, like, I said to Steve before, my first sort of tick in the box is going to be to be with Ben at 15 miles. Like, I didn't want to get dropped before then. Even if I was feeling bad, I was committing to that. And then obviously the sort of racing started happening, and yeah, even then you're sort of playing scenarios in the head. I knew Johnny was going to make a move at some point around 20 miles, I'd guessed. And that's pretty much what happened. And then I sort of had to gauge off of what he was doing, how the others reacted to his move. You know, how was I feeling? What did I think I could sort of, what effort could I pour out then over the next sort of 6 miles? And yeah, I think I played it really well. And there was a few sort of roller coaster moments, but it was one of those where I'd say I never really felt good, but at the same time, I never really felt that bad. Like I had one sort of dip at about 12, 13 miles. But again, I just went to that process of, no, you're running with the lead group to 15 miles. So just get back in. And then, yeah, literally 2 miles later, I was feeling fine again.
Yeah, that's a good take. Do you think, you know, in future, this was kind of your first marathon that you'd actually finished, wasn't it? London was a DNF. So yeah, when you say Johnny made that move at 20 miles, do you think like Ross Millington in a year or so time, you'll probably go with that? You won't care so much about kind of getting to the end and judging that last effort. And I guess that's that next level, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, it was difficult because I knew what shape Johnny was in. And I knew, like, you've got to be honest with yourself. I knew I wasn't in as good a shape as Johnny, you know, but then again, it is the marathon and strange things happen. But yeah, because I knew I'd banked that time going through halfway, I just wanted to get this one done. Like, I didn't want to take a massive, massive risk. Because in the marathon, like, if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. It's not like in, you know, you can, in a 10K, you sort of, you can be so close to the finish and take a swing and it's still not that bad. Whereas in the marathon, you could be walking at 24 miles. Like, it could be that bad. So, like, I knew within myself how I was feeling, and we'd done the long run. So I just kept using that as my reference of like 22 miles in a long run that I've done in training. How do I feel now compared to that? And I felt similar. So I was confident in what I could do. But yeah, to answer your question, I think 12 months down the line, I'll be in a position where, you know, I can definitely react to moves like that and hopefully be knocking on that door of 210 at some point over the next few years. It'd be really good.
For sure. Obviously, like Matt and I discussed the things we wanted to chat to you about before the podcast. And one of the things that came up was we can't really think of recently many people who 5K, 10K wise, particularly on the men's side, who've gone to the Olympics and then actually stepped up to the marathon. Because I think historically it's always been that is the optimum way as a distance runner to move up is to go through the distances. And not to say that the marathon guys now aren't good 5K runners, but yourself obviously went to Rio in 2016. Do you think that gives you an advantage now taking on these marathons?
I don't know if it gives me, I mean, obviously my 10K ability, yeah, it was, you know, it's quite a long time ago now since I've been down at that sort of, you know, running those sort of times, but, you know, I've still done it. I've still been there. So I do, yeah, hopefully that will be an advantage to me come some point in a marathon, you know, especially hopefully championship marathons that could be tactical, and knowing that I have that sort of, you know, when it comes to the marathon, you're talking about speed with regards to the 10K. So yeah, hopefully that will be to my advantage. And yeah, I guess, I mean, I think Callum sort of broke that mold really with, you know, because you had obviously like John Brown went 5K, 10K marathon. And like you say, that was the tradition sort of thing. But then Callum just came out at however old he was, 22, 24, and went to Rio in the marathon. And I think Dowie saw that and thought he'd give it a crack. I guess Johnny's been fairly similar to me, though he did start his marathon career quite young. And I think that is the sort of trend now, especially with the Africans that are now Europeans, seem to be going to the marathon a lot younger. But yeah, I guess my career just followed that sort of old school sort of pathway sort of thing. And yeah, obviously in the last few years with injury hasn't helped. You know, it's meant I've had to delay the start to my marathon career. So, you know, I'm starting probably far later than I'd ever imagined or wanted to, but I think Charlie Spedding only ran his first marathon when he was 32. So if I can replicate anything he did in this short space of time, then I'd be happy.
Well, yeah, and what did you keep up an element of speed in that marathon build-up?
Yeah, so we started off sort of like Ollie will have seen on the Middlewood Way. We started off with, you know, quite hard fartleks, like more 10K half marathon type training. And then we sort of go into a marathon block and then sort of bring in a bit more sort of turnover in speed again, more towards the end sort of thing. Mm. But I think most of our sort of Tuesday sessions were still on the track through the whole build up. So we always sort of retained an element. And then obviously, because I was coming from that injury, like I had to keep touching on that anyway to make the, you know, you got to try and make that 5 minute mile pace as easy as possible. So you got, you know, you got to bring in that 10K work from below it sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And then, you know, you talk about you moved to marathon a little bit later than you maybe would have liked. But why did you move? You know, why did you feel you wanted to move or you had to move? Was it financially better off or is it just something you've always wanted to do?
Yeah, it's always something I wanted to do. Obviously, you know, in 2016, I was really happy running the 10K. And I think my goal was to go 10K probably at Tokyo. But yeah, that sort of 2019, I was quite badly injured and it just took me a long time to recover. And then just that ability to get on the track and run the harder sessions just hasn't been there because mainly because of the injury problems. But obviously, as much as I like to deny it, age is becoming a bit of a factor now. So yeah. Well, I'd never say never to the track, but I feel like I'm quite well suited to the marathon event now. So I'm ready to just sort of commit to that and go with that going forwards, really.
Does it almost feel like a fresh start, if you like, with the marathon? Because it, I guess 5K to 10K, that difference probably doesn't feel big to some people and the same people who move from 1500 to the 5K. But does a change from going from track to road feel like almost a new chapter of the career, if you like?
Yeah, it definitely does to me now. I've done one. Yeah, definitely. Like I just really wanted to get one under my belt. Like I've been trying for so long and, you know, built up for London in at the start of 2020 before it got cancelled in April. You know, we went back to a big build up then for October 2020, DNF'd. I'd already tried to build up for a marathon in 2017, I think, but I had to can it due to injury. So I was just, you know, done these build-ups and never got sort of, you know, never done one. And so to now to actually have one under my belt and have it gone well, qualified for a championships, hopefully in the summer. All my injury problems are sort of behind me. So I'm ready to, definitely attack now this next few years of my career over the marathon.
Interesting you chose, you know, sounds like you got the Europeans as a goal. Interesting you chose like a championship marathon over, you know, attacking a quick full marathon as well. I quite like that idea because I think I was talking to someone the other day about, I think British runners need to use these championship marathons more as stepping stones rather than just keep attacking London year on year on year.
Yeah, 100%. Like if you look at it, it's probably only Callum that's run well a championship marathon for us. I'm probably forgetting someone, so forgive my ignorance, but I love racing. I love representing, you know, Great Britain, England, whoever it is. And, you know, championships for me is why I do the sport. And it's obviously been so long since I've made a team as well. So, yeah, going back to last year when we said we wanted to do Manchester, the reason was because we wanted to qualify for a championship. So, you know, the times will take care of themselves at the bigger, you know, faster marathons. So I'm not that worried about missing a full marathon. I'd rather, you know, gear up now and run a real, you know, a proper championship marathon because, it really excites me. It's what I want to do.
How would the preparation differ, do you think?
I think, obviously, first of all, heat's got to be a factor. So we're definitely going to have to plan for that. You know, I'll have to probably get away a few times between now and sort of end of July, August. And then I don't think I don't think I need to change any more with the training. Hopefully even starting from a better place, you know, over the next few weeks now, getting back running. You know, I'll still have a lot longer time to build up than I did for this one. So, yeah, I don't want to change too much. Steve and I will probably sit down with Johnny and sort of have a review of you know, what we think worked, what didn't work sort of thing. But yeah, I don't want to fall into the trap that I have done before of sort of thinking, right, now I have to go and do more volume. I have to run everything quicker. Because yeah, it doesn't work like that.
What are the aims then, I guess, for the next three, four years in terms of you and the marathon?
I'd love to make an Olympic team again. I'd love to make an Olympic team over the marathon. So I think that will be my ultimate goal. And then it's difficult because, you know, you look at guys like Mo, guys like Tomo, you know, these guys are extending, you know, they're extending their careers massively. Whereas, you know, I'm sat at 32 thinking, shit, I've only got 2 years of running left when, you know, I might be doing this for the next 8 years. So yeah, I'm just going to take things as they come. And just see what happens really. But yeah, Olympic team, and then yeah, probably going to be greedy and want to say that, yeah, I definitely want to break 210 at some point.
Mate, touch upon it there. Let's talk about Rio a little bit, because, you know, rewind, we spoke about Ross Millington today, but like you said, you were a fantastic 10,000 meter runner. You went to Rio. How hard is it to qualify, you know, in the Olympics on that Olympic year? You know, you've just spoke about injury and how it affects your preparations kind of year on year on year, but getting it right on that year, you know, how difficult was that? And obviously you with Farah during Rio.
Yeah.
So what that was like.
Yeah, it was hard, but again, like, just as has happened this year, sort of in 2015, when those standards come out, or when I actually looked at them, and I saw it was 28 minutes. Like, at that point, I hadn't run a 10K, but I remember saying to Steve, I was like, I can do that. 100% I can do that. And he said the same thing. So setting out from the start of 2016 was always the sort of the goal. And again, same thing. I just went through the process. Like, my first 10K out in Stanford went horribly, terribly. That was me thinking I was going to debut and run 27:50 and be the dog's bollocks. And I ran 28:38, got lapped. And I was thinking, shit, have I made a big mistake here? But like, we'd just come off a big sort of altitude block at Flagstaff, and I think I just hadn't absorbed the work I'd been doing. So we came home, went back to basics, won at Highgate, which was the first thing I needed to do for Olympic selection. And I think I had another month or so training before I went and attacked the qualifying time out in Holland. And again, going to sound like a broken record, just back to process. Like, for that qualifying race, all we wanted to do was get to 5,000 meters in 14 minutes. That was literally as far as my thinking went. And I went through 14 minutes on the nose, and then I just started feeling better and better then through that race. And yeah, I ended up running 27:55, which, you know, today probably it doesn't sound that impressive, but, you know,
it was
in 2016, you know, not many Europeans were breaking 28 minutes on the track. So yeah, it was a run I was really happy with. And you know, if you'd have asked me on that night what were you, you know, sat here today, what I thought I'd have run over 10,000 meters, I'd have thought I'd have gone a lot quicker, but obviously circumstances, injuries over the past few years, I haven't been able to do it. But yeah, that's still a run I'm really proud of, and obviously it earned me that Olympic selection.
Yeah, let's talk about the Olympics themselves and how was the kind of overall experience of Rio, because I always feel like sometimes athletes reflect on it and actually it's the fact of making it in the first place that beats out the actual process of being there.
Yes. It's just so hard. Like, obviously, like, before then I hadn't qualified for a championships on the track. So I'd gone from like nothing, like I hadn't gone to Europeans, I hadn't gone to a Worlds. Wow. I'd gone from you know, winning British champs to bang make an Olympic final. So yeah, it was kind of strange, but I honestly thought it was going to run well. But you know, we went up to Font Romeu, and in hindsight, I probably overcooked things a little bit. Because you know, you go into the Olympic Games, you're going to be running against, you know, the creme de la creme. You know, Mo Farah's there, everyone's there, all these guys that I've been following over the years, and I'm going to be stood on a start line with them. So me running 6 by a mile in 4:40, like I had been to run 27:55, just felt I would need to go and run 6 by a mile in 4:20 faster. And it just caught up with me, and I think I just overcooked it a little bit, and I didn't have the, you know, it was far from what I wanted to run during the actual race. But I was ready to just sort of take it on the chin, and I was ready to sort of go again that next year. But like before, I just fell into that trap of thinking I had to train harder, you know, more, do more volume, all that sort of thing. And it was a good lesson to learn. You only learn it once. So yeah, it was unfortunate.
I was gonna say, it sounds so easy to do, and I think a lot of people do it, but you know, any advice to try and not overcook it? You know, you've learned now, but any advice for people out there who are kind of chasing times, and is it just kind of leave it all to a race day?
It's tough, yeah, because sometimes you have to learn by doing. And even if that means that you have to make mistakes to sort of learn, then, you know, if things do go wrong, as long as you're learning, then it's not a bad thing. Obviously, you don't want to keep making mistakes, because, you know, then it just becomes a bit redundant. As long as you can sit down and look back and actually think, no, this is where I'm wrong, this is what I'm going to do. And then, you know, you have to surround yourself with the right people. You have to speak to the right people, you know, coaches, managers, other athletes. You know, don't be afraid to have conversations and ask opinions, and, you know, share, you know, your experiences and your training with others, and, you know, ask for their insight, sort of thing. And it's a tough one, because at the end of the day, we all just want to run quick and be the best that we can be. And it's just figuring out what works for you. And I think that's what I've gotten really good at over the years, is I sort of know what type of athlete I am. You know, I'm not someone that can go and run 6 minute pace on my easy days every day. Like, that'd be over within a week for me. I'd be injured, ill, not finishing sessions. So it's, you know, you just got to be a bit of a student of the sport, and just try and implement things on yourself. That'd be my advice.
Look, the standard was 28 minutes when you went to Rio. It's now, is it 27, 28 or something? Or 27?
Yeah.
I think it's just inside 27, 30. Is that a good or a bad thing? You know, lowering the standards that much, making them that much harder. Do you think it's good or bad?
I mean, it can be good in the respect that obviously the sports move forward, and, you know, if they deem that the same sort of representation is going to be going for, you know, in terms of Africans, Europeans, you know, Asians, you know, if they're still getting that same representation, then I think it's a good thing. But if it means that it's going to be a field of 18 Africans, then I don't think it's a good thing. Obviously, we have to wait and see now what sort of happens over the next few years. People are obviously running a lot faster. You know, there's many, many Europeans breaking 28 minutes now on the track. You know, there's many Brits breaking 28 minutes on the track now. So I think that's a positive, but we just have to see when it gets to the championships what sort of decisions that the IOC or World Athletics are going to be making. You know, I just want to see fields with, you know, a diverse representation, because that, you know, that's what the Olympics should be.
And I think it bodes for better races as well. You know, because we're in a climate now where the times are so hard to get that people are gearing their seasons towards just about a chasing time. You can't even think about the champs almost, when it's a very difficult task to get the time. Where if more people maybe had that time, they could then focus on racing a little bit more, and we'd see more people race.
Yeah, it's a tough one. It is a tough one, because obviously you've got to have these standards in place for people to qualify. But yeah, they are getting to a point now where, that is the be all and end all. And some of the standards are so hard that that's almost all you focus on. And then, you know, you can be in a position where you achieve it and then you sat there thinking, oh, shit, I've got a major championships to run in 4 weeks time and I haven't really planned beyond this point. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but that, yeah, I think that is the trap that people can fall into quite easily.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, throughout this pod already, you've mentioned your coach Steve Owens quite a bit. Obviously, there's been some like recent news about changes at New Balance Manchester. Do you mind talking a bit about that and just kind of where that leaves you?
Yeah, so all I know is what you guys know pretty much. You know, Steve will be joining British Athletics in May. So, yeah, he won't be coach of Team New Balance anymore. We've got Helen Clitheroe that will be taking the team forward. I'll still be part of the team. And yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, for sure. Is that, obviously for you, obviously it's a kind of change for all the athletes, but you yourself, you've been with Steve for so long and you've mentioned kind of the chats you've had and how that's influenced, like, I guess, things at Rio and then also this marathon build up. How different is that going to be?
Yeah, it's really sad that Steve's leaving. You know, he's been my coach for 12 years maybe. So it is sad, but obviously I have to look at it as a positive because, you know, look at where he's gotten himself to, and you know, I'm really happy for him. You know, it's a job that, you know, years and years ago when we'd speak about, you know, how he wanted to develop his coaching, you know, all like that is always something he aspired to. So for him to finally be there, you know, I think that's a great testament to what he's done over the past few years. And I think he's going to make a fantastic contribution to endurance running in Great Britain. So yeah, I can't be,
yeah,
you know, it's difficult because I'm, you know, personally, I'm sad that he won't be my coach anymore, but at the same time, as you know, I'm proud that I could have been part of his journey to now get for him to be where he is. And then again, a testament to his coaching, you know, I'm at a stage now where, you know, I'm 32. A lot of the sort of training is a conversation between Steve and I, and Johnny's similar position to me. You know, Steve will sort of show us the plan, you know, and he's happy for me or Johnny to make suggestions, contributions, and, you know, it's very much a two-way street now. So I'm definitely not in a position where I'm like, you know, if he was to stop coaching me tomorrow, I wouldn't be sat there thinking, shit, what do I do? You know, and then obviously, like I said, we've got the guidance of Helen coming in now. So, you know, as an athlete, there's not many that have done much more than her on the international stage. So, yeah, we're still going to be in really good hands. I think the team's going to keep moving forward, and Steve's left a great legacy that I'm sure he wants to see continue, because it's only to the benefit of endurance running in Britain.
Mm. What was it like being coached by Steve? You're reasonably close in age. Like you said, rumor has you very good friends as well. That's a very rare relationship, coach and athlete, in the distance running world, I would say.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique situation. So to give us some context, Steve and I are both Stockport Harriers. When I started at Stockport at 12 years old, Steve was at Butler University, I think, or maybe just about to go. And we both had the same coach in Dave Turnbull. He was a fantastic coach, and coached me all the way up until I went out to America. So I ended up going to New Mexico with Coach Joe Franklin, who'd been at Butler with Steve. So there was that sort of connection there, yeah. And then Steve ended up coaching me, yeah, in about 2010. And so, yeah, it is a very unique situation. And obviously, like I say, I've known him since I was 12 years old. So it'd be hard to find a sort of relationship like that that's, you know, on a personal level and on a coaching level. So yeah, it's been great. And, you know, I'm really, really grateful for everything that he's done, and hopefully he can say the same to me. You know, I'm sure have helped quite a bit with his coach education over the years. But yeah.
So you were friends off the track as well as on the track. So how did you kind of, you know, separate that and, you know, be mates as well as athlete and coach?
There was never really any sort of separation in it.
Right.
Because we've always just been, you know, going back to the days with Dave Turnbull, it was, you know, we'd always be having a laugh. And then when it came time to train, it was like, that's when you get serious. That's when it's time to train. So that's how I've operated. That's how Steve operated. And then that's how I've sort of operated under Steve all these years. So yeah, obviously there has to be, I have to realize sort of in team situations that I can't be, you know, that personal stuff sort of has to be left on the side a little bit. But you know, that's the same in any sort of professional setup. It was just, yeah, it's just knowing when, you know, when you had to sort of switch things a little bit. But yeah, it's never been a problem. You know, he can shout at me as much as he wants to shout at any other athlete. There's no problems there.
Yeah, let's chat about New Balance Manchester a bit, because you're obviously there from the start of it all, and it still remains the only I guess single sponsor pro group in the UK.
Yeah, which is quite surprising. I think we'd almost hoped that people would try and replicate it, and people have, but it is difficult. You know, we get a lot of backing from New Balance, and I don't think people realize how much it does take to sort of back a team like that, just to get it started and then to keep it going and sort of implement a culture that can sort of, you know, keep going, keep turning over athletes and producing results. But yeah, it's great. It's, you know, it's been going 7 years-ish now, six years. So yeah, that's obviously why, you know, even with Steve leaving now, we want to make sure that this thing keeps going. And like I say, I'm committed to it. All the other athletes are committed to it. You know, there'll be some additions coming in the next few weeks and months. And, you know, eventually when I retire, you know, I hope it's still going, and I hope there's a real legacy there.
Yeah. I wonder why we haven't seen many people. I think when we spoke to Steve, he kind of highlighted how much backing that you really needed to get a group like that off the ground. And like you say, just continue it. Cause I think we've seen stuff kind of start and then fizzle out. And things have never continued in that culture that you've got a New Balance and that pipeline of athletes as well.
Yeah, I think it is the backing. And obviously, you know, you're talking financial, like the house is quite a big thing. Cause you know, when I started, there's no way I could, you know, couldn't afford to live, you know, I couldn't afford to pay rent. I'd have had to have got a job. So straight away, it sort of takes away that main burden and pressure on you. So, you know, when I first moved there, 2015, 2016, 2015, when we got the house, I think, yeah, like that was it. All I was having to worry about was putting food on the table. Like there was no worry about rent or bills or anything. You know, I was literally full-time training and focused on that. And, you know, obviously now I'm at the position where I've managed to move out of the house and be on my own. Johnny's the same. Kira's the same. So, but even then, when people are moving out of the house, we were all living close together. So, again, that's just a testament to the sort of team culture that we've got. You know, even when you're moving out, it's not like people are like, that's it, I've had enough, I'm going to move back to wherever I'm from or where significant others from or that sort of thing. People are committed still to staying in the area and training together.
Cross country, you were, like you said, 2015, I think it was 2015, I watched you at Liverpool absolutely fly around and demolish the field there. You know, you've had good success over cross country. Will we ever see you back on it?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, good. Liverpool. I mean, there's a Liverpool next year.
Yeah, I mean, already I've been thinking probably if there's a championship marathon July, August, then I'd hope hopefully European Cross will be on the cards at the end of this year. And then obviously there's World Cross next year. So yeah, I love cross country. I think we need to keep it as a foundation sport for as long as we can, because, you know, grassroots sports, that's how it all starts for the kids, sort of thing. So I think trying to keep it at a high level in the senior ranks is really important to endurance running in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Matt obviously mentioned Liverpool just then. What is it you think about that course that's made you so, I guess, dominant whenever you've raced there?
I don't know if it's the course. I think it's just the preparation we do beforehand. You know, whenever I've run there, I've always been ready. You know, we've always been focusing on the European Cross. So that training at that time of year really suits me quite well. You know, when it's a fair amount of volume, sort of progressive runs, and then you sort of sprinkle in a few sort of 10K sessions. That just seems to get me in really good shape for 10K cross, really. You know, Steve has a great cross country background, so, you know, he knows what he's doing when it comes to that. And I just love the racing. I love Liverpool. Like, the crowd's always really good. Even if it's muddy, it's still a good course. You know, you always have that, everything going into it, you know, the talk of who's going to make the team. You know, there's always sort of a solid three or four. There's always that one outlier that nobody thinks of. There's always the one person that's been smashing everything since the end of August and is absolutely cooked by the time of the race. They always go under the favourite tag. I just love it. Just love it. It's a great, yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned the mud there. Are you someone who, do you train for the mud, or do you just have a natural ability to glide over it? Because I know Matt mentioned that 2015 race, and I've never seen anyone run like the way that you carried your form in that race, like your running style, even on that course. I know anyone who was there will remember how bad it was.
I think before that, I think we'd been in Kenya, so we weren't, like, all my training is sort of off road, like on the trails. But sessions wise, we do some work on the grass, like in cross country season, but not a ton. I think it's just, you know, we're always really strong, like we're running on up and down the hills around here, and you know, we do decent amount of sort of core and strength work through the week. So yeah, I think it's just getting out and running on the hills and stuff. It doesn't look good on the Garmin, but it looks good when you're in cross country races.
Yeah, I think Izzy mentioned that as well, that hilly terrain that you do up at Manchester. Every run is pretty hilly.
Yeah. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, all my runs, if I average under 650, like, that's a fast run for me. Yeah, we just love getting at it. Like, it's just a great area. You know, Ollie's seen a little bit of it. But yeah, it's just, you can switch off, go and easy run in Lyme Park and go up and down the hills, and yeah, that's just the type of running I love to do.
Yeah. Talk about Aarhus, the World Cross. You obviously went there, incredibly tough course. And is the World Cross just one of the most humbling experiences? And do you want to go back and try and, you know, better that performance?
Yeah, that course was, it was something else. It didn't help that, you know, I was already going in with the sort of the beginnings of a few sort of injury problems. And I certainly came away with a few injury problems. Very, very humbling experience. The only thing I could compare it to is when I ran NCAA crosses, like a freshman or a sophomore, you know, just having hundreds of guys on a much higher level than you is not fun. It makes for a very long sort of 30 minutes of hard work, but yeah, I still love it, still absolutely love it. And didn't have a great run, like I say, so it's definitely one that I'd love to go back to and have a much better run at. I think it's in Australia next year, so
it's, yeah,
yeah, that'd be a good one, a good way to get Australia ticked off my bucket list as well. But yeah, I think, like I said before, you know, I think it's really important that cross country is an event that we support, you know, all the way through the age groups. and senior age groups. So hopefully that is the case with British athletics next year. But
yeah, totally agree, man. There's just one thing that I was on your Para 10, noticed that, you know, you maybe were under John Brown for a little bit. Obviously an incredible athlete. Was that like a permanent thing? Did you leave Steve for a little while? If so, why?
Yeah, there was a few. It was, it was just a period where I wasn't really. I was a little bit undecided on what direction I wanted to take. So I wanted to just take a step back, and I had a few sort of months, you know, call it a sabbatical if you want, of just sort of waiting and assessing what I wanted to do. And in that time, yeah, John's someone I'd been speaking to since 2015, maybe, you know. He was always happy to offer sort of insights and his experiences, you know, like, you know, he's been there and done it, you know, fourth at two Olympics and, you know, 27, 18, you know, with 10K, you know, he was an incredible athlete. So yeah, he was kind enough to sort of be happy for me to bounce ideas off him. And yeah, eventually I sort of made my decision on which way I wanted to go going forward. And that was going back in the team and working with Steve.
Mm. Okay.
But yeah, invaluable experience.
Kind of almost like, I think when you've been in a team for so long, did you just kind of almost, you know, dip your toe in the water and see what else is out there?
Yeah. It was just a period like, yeah, personal life, sort of just sort of trying to figure out what sort of direction I wanted to go in, really, and where I wanted to be. Did I still want to be in Manchester? Did I want to sort of think about trying somewhere else? But at the end of the day, yeah, I realized how good we have it here. So just stay committed.
I mean, that is a good thing to do, though. And the way, obviously, like you speak about there, the way you did it and then chose to go back. I think a lot of people, this is me from the outside looking in, seem to... they have some success in a place and then they just stay there regardless of considering like some other options, even if they have it doesn't matter if your relationship's great with your coach, but sometimes it might just be you need a fresh scenery, for example.
Yeah, exactly that. You know, obviously with the high of 2016 and then, you know, I hadn't been back there sort of thing at that level, and I sort of had to, yeah, it was just a time to step back and sort of think, why? Is it something I'm doing? Is it something within the group that's not working for me? Is it coaching that's not working for me? So instead of being unhappy around everybody else and inflicting that on everybody else, I just wanted to sort of step away, let them get on with what they're doing without worrying about me, and just to give me the time and space to actually review a few things and try and come up with some answers and what I thought going forward. Which can be a difficult thing to do. You know, there was some difficult conversations with Steve, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, everything worked out and, you know, everyone was really supportive when I did come back, when I made that decision to come back. So, hopefully it's all worked out and hopefully they'll all say the same thing.
I think so, man. Look, nearing the end, it's kind of altitude season, it's training camp season. What's been your favorite training camp ever, like where and why?
I think Kenya for me. Yeah, just simple life. Like I don't like a lot of things going on around me. You know, if I can just sort of hold myself away somewhere and get on with training every day, then I'm really happy. And yeah, Kenya's probably an extreme of that, but it's just such an inspiring place as well. You know, I'd recommend anybody to go there at least once just to experience it, really. You know, it's very humbling experience. You know, you see how some people live and what it, you know, how they live on so, you know, on so little, yet their lives are so rich and a lot richer than many people are in the Western world. So that at that time when I first went out in 2015, it did give me sort of a bit of a different perspective on life and sort of what was important. And then I also found just the countryside and the trails. It's all green and brown. There's no gray. you know, just inspiring every day, even when you're absolutely knackered. You know, I was always looking forward to going out for a run. So yeah, always a place that I'll hold dear, because, you know, I always ran well off of it as well. I think we really got the training right when we went there and when we came back. And then, yeah, obviously there's a lot of fantastic places out there. St. Moritz is fantastic. Flagstaff's an incredible place. You know, I was in Albuquerque for 5 years at university. It's always a great place to go back to. Font-Romeu is a great place. I'm sure there's a few places I've not experienced.
That's a good point to touch on. Do you reckon being at Albuquerque, you know, for 5 years, did that accelerate your career much better than perhaps if you'd have stayed at sea level at that time? Do you ever think about that?
I hope so, because it's one of the reasons I went there. It was sort of,
yeah,
even at that point in my career, I mean, how old was I? 18, 19. You know, I was already thinking about that sort of long-term development and what that could give me. So I'm going to say yeah and say I was right. but no, I think, yeah, jokes aside, I think at that, you know, in those developmental years, I think it is important. Because now I'm probably, you know, like I did this marathon build up with zero altitude. I do still think it's important, but maybe, you know, at my age now and sort of the volume I can run now, maybe less so. But, you know, I think from late teens through to sort of late 20s, I think you have to be doing it, really. Otherwise, you're at a major disadvantage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just before we finish then, which event do you think is the hardest to train for? Like the 10K on the track, the marathon, cross, and then which is your favorite as well?
3K is one of the, yeah, because the sessions that are involved. Just that real, yeah, for me personally, I find that VO2 max type work is, you know, it's horrible, isn't it? Track, headache, yeah, everything that goes with it. Marathon, I love marathon training. It's not easy, but I love going out every day, minimum 15 miles a day.
Wow.
Yeah, I love that sort of thing. Yeah, maybe it's my age now that I don't want to go to the track and run 6 by a mile or, you know, mile cut downs or any of that sort of thing. It looks good. It looks good on Instagram and all that, but yeah, it's not for me anymore.
Is it a bit of marathon training, like mentally, that not the cumulative aspect, but like day by day, what you get asked to do, you probably know you can do it. You might not know that you could stack it all together, but whereas, say, a track session, Steve might have set something and you actually don't know whether you can physically run that fast.
Yes, exactly that. Because there's not, other than when you're sat in a car waiting to do 24 miles, there's nothing, there's never anything on paper that you like, where you like look again and think, shit, what does that say? It is exactly that. But then obviously the, you know, the aspect of the longer stuff comes into it, which is, you know, where it can be hard. But yeah, and then it does end up just being the accumulation of things, because all of a sudden you can get to, well, I had one of those sessions. It was, when was it? Must be going back 4 weeks ago now, where it was literally one of those sessions that I looked at and I was like, yeah, no problem, I'll get that done, no problem. Didn't happen. Had a rough one. But I definitely, you know, looking back, it was probably a good thing, because it, you know, it refocused me a little bit, and you got to get your head back on air now for this next 3 weeks. You know, the work isn't done. But yeah, it's always ups and downs. It's always a roller coaster. You just got to sort of learn to go with it. No matter what you're training for, really.
Yeah, sure. Well, Ross, it's been great to chat to you today. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
No problem. Thank you, guys.